Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
And gentlemen, let's get ready to be inspired! Introducing in the red corner, American Tennis! And introducing in the blue corner, your host for American Tennis, Mr. Chuck Griese! Ladies and gentlemen, time to get in the game.
And hello once again. This is Coach Chuck Griese. Every Wednesday at noon, you can listen to American Tennis on the UR Tennis Network. Now, you can get every show on the UR Tennis Network, including Lisa Stone's Parenting Aces, Jason Haynes's program, 2 hours from right now. On the College Connection, Jason always interviews a collegiate coach every Wednesday at 2 o'clock Eastern Time, 1 o'clock Central Time. Also, I want to remind you about the Yellow Ball Network and J.P. Weber. And J.P. Weber, We Coach Tennis website and program has done quite well. Listen to them on Tuesdays. But this is American Tennis, and I am Coach Chuck Griese. Every week you can listen to controversial or not so controversial issues on the UR Tennis Network. You can call in also, and please do and contribute if you have ideas or you'd just like to talk about some tennis issues of the week or politics or what's going on in college, junior, or the 10 and under ranks or anything at all you'd like to talk about. We ask you, the issue here is always to stand up and to speak out. Say those things that you want to say. On the UR Tennis Network, you're allowed to do this, and we just ask you to stay professional, address issues, not people. Call area code 714-583-6853. That's 714-583-6853. This is the UR Tennis Network, the letter U, the letter R, the number 10, and the letter S. Go to your iPhone and just punch in UR Tennis Network. It'll come up, and the very first item there, it says Blog Talk Radio, and you hit it, and every show will come up for you. We always say on the American Tennis program that all that it takes for evil to prosper is for good people. Our good men to do nothing, as Edmund Burke said. We always quote that, and we say that it is so appropriate because we really are to place folks where we do talk about cliches and facts, and we don't go deeper to opinions, feelings, and needs. I was talking to a official today at one of our tennis bureaucracies, and I said, well, nobody speaks up. How are you, in the world are you supposed to listen or to anything or to know what's going on? Because people don't speak up. People get afraid. They get afraid of being bullied. They get afraid of being, they don't like being mandated to, but they pretty much, we need your voice. We need everybody's voice out there to talk up about what's going on. 2 weeks ago, I got to go to a tennis summit down for the USTA down in Florida, and I've got to say it was very, very well done, and hats off to Bill Mountford and Scott Schultz and those guys, Kent Kinnear and the other USTA officials that put that on. It was a very, very well-prepared and very informative 72 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours. And a lot of, I don't want to say, let's say not arguing, let's say discussions back and forth. But it's a fact that they're trying to push forward a little bit the idea of dumping the 12 and under rankings. They think that pressure is bad for kids. And, you know, it might be for some. All youngsters are wired a little bit differently. But, you know, they really had a good forum to speak, and they brought in three consultants, and this was a little bit disturbing in that the consultants really get a lot of credence. And you know, they're experts in their field. They brought in one child psychologist guy who was, you know, into how learning takes place, and it's got to be a fun environment. And I don't think anybody agree with that. I think the word fun, instead of fun, for people to take up tennis and stay with tennis would be a passionate environment, or helping the kids become passionate about what they're doing. So they had that fella in, and they had another a lady in that was a marketing person and how to market tennis and all this and their marketing research. And then they had a guy in, a child psychologist guy, about, you know, stress and pressure and all these things. And I just sat back and I just said, you know, big organizations do this a lot. They will bring in a third party to sort of give their ideas. And if it works out well, the big organization looks great. But if it doesn't work out well, they sort of can wash their hands of those consultants and go on to somebody else. But it just sort of hit me that these guys that are doing this, and then he had a fella give the opening talk that was very much into saying he had his research done on exercise for young people and all this. And this is all good. I'm not meaning to say that it's not good. It's all good. These folks should not be making the decisions. And I just, to the USTA, I'm just asking you, and I don't think that you are, but my golly, these third parties should not be the experts in our sport of tennis. You're the experts out there. You, the coaches listening to this, and everybody who's in the battlefield every day in the field of development of our young people, the teachers and the coaches out there. Outstanding presentations at the USTA summit by the national volleyball, the hockey coach, pretty darn interesting about the hockey, and he did have some interesting ideas how they've made the rings smaller for the smaller kids and trying to get the skating down, right, and shortening it and small. And the analogy there, the comparison I know that the USTA was happy about was us using smaller courts, and I wanted to say something about that. It took us about 25 years to figure that one out, but when they changed the technology of the rackets, they went to these high-tech rackets away from the wood rackets. Ball striking overcame movement. We all saw that. And for the first 10 years in the 80s, people were wondering, you know, what the heck it helped. Some people would say volleys, some people say serves, some would help returns. And for the first 10 years in the 80s, everyone used a old-school technical the technique, the linear stances, the linear grips, the linear follow-throughs. But then it evolved in the early 90s, didn't it? The ball striking started to get so big. Everyone talked about first strike tennis, during that period. And those who had big first strike tennis won a lot. And then what was pretty cool is that in the late 90s, you had players like that would come along, and I think Federer started emerging then. And the players that could move where there's movement to the ball, recovery steps, and their shot selection became pro, like the pro tennis that we see today. And the players now are actually the best ones are playing ping pong out there, aren't they? It's so fast. To give you an idea, Vic Braden, I remember he had all the statistics on this, but back in the 70s and 60s when we did use the wood rackets, it took 4 seconds for a ball to travel to you and then back to me if we were playing each other. And then now it's 2.1 seconds, he said. And the ball's traveling over 60 miles an hour, which is 88 feet a second. Well, the court is 78 feet long. So, wow, it takes 1 second, basically, for it to get from you to me. And one more second to get back. And Vic Braden confirmed that. But, you know, when you look at the implications of a 100-yard dash man going, 10 flat is 30 feet a second. Well, that has a darn good correlation to the width of a court, doesn't it? So if I am on one side of the court and you hit it down the line, the perfect down the line change of direction shot from across court to a down the line, takes 1 second for you to hit it, and I would have to be a 10-flat, 100-yard dash man to be able to cover that. Now, everybody sees this. Everybody senses this, and our players learn power first. This is just the evolution of what has happened with the game. The players learn power. Then we have to back up and learn the skill sets of consistency, placement, depth, and spin. And it used to be in that order, didn't it? Consistency, placement, depth, spin, power used to be last, now it's first. So as teachers, as coaches, we really have a tough job, don't we? You watch the players play, and you cannot tell who's winning or losing without a scoreboard or if the body language was equal. In the old days, you used to be able to tell. You used to be able to walk over and say, well, this person is going to be a top player, this person is not, this person is average. But it is very, very hard to discern the difference between a top ball striker and someone who's not, and a top player is someone who's not. I mean, you can see it at the best players, but it is unbelievably hard in the just sort of average to good players. And all the players are sort of log jammed. So where are the differences going to be made? Anyhow, it's it's really interesting to me. So 25 years later, as I was saying, 25 years later, we come out with smaller courts, softer balls, and dang it. I used, after a great conversation with Tut Bartson years ago, who is the master of masters as far as keeping balls into play. His players used to be so tough and so mentally tough as far as keeping balls in the court. I used to use a lot of dead balls back in the 90s, trying to get the players to have some semblance of being able to keep the ball in the court. And then, of course, the smaller courts, softer balls, and it's sort of equaled out the high-tech rackets. Wouldn't it have been easier if we just had not had all these high-tech rackets? Dang it, it's been an interesting revolution. But then I guess also the racket technology and the sales of those rackets have sort of kept tennis afloat as well. But anyhow, the USTA summit down there was good. But getting back to finishing what I was saying, the USA hockey and the USA volleyball and the USA lacrosse coaches were quite interested. And again, they were coaches. They weren't a third party. So that was very interesting. USTA is trying to do a good job, but what can you do with a bureaucracy or a company that is that big? Put down system after system. We need incentives. This last week they hired I think a very, very good man, Martin Blackman. I've known Martin since junior tennis, and nobody out there will argue that that's just genuinely a very kind, very noble, and a very intelligent man, and I think it's a good pick. I really, really do for the director of player development. I think on many, many fronts that was a good pick. There are many good people out there, but let's see how this one works out. Let's see how he does have experience with USDA as well, so he knows the politics and inner workings. So I think he's going to be able to get some things done, but we'll wait and see. Well, this is American Tennis, and I'm Coach Chuck Creasy. If you want to call in, it's area code. Let's see again here. Oh, got it. Area code 714-583-6853. This is UR Tennis Network. If you ever want my blogs or information on my camps, the books, I've written the 6 books that I have out there, also some of my writings. Also, you can get every American Tennis radio show and over the past 3 years just by going to chuckcreasy.net, Chuck Creasy, K-R-I-E-S-E.net, and you can punch up the shows, and we have a good explanation about every show, so a lot of people to we've picked a lot of people's brains, and we've gotten some great information, and you can use it as you want. Right now we're going to go to a quick commercial. We'll be back here in a minute. I'm hoping Coach Randy Blumenthal will be on the line. He's got a lot to share with his ideas on what the perfect college tennis season will be. This is Chuck Creasy. We'll be right back.
Coach J.P. Weber of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. In my 30 years experience in coaching tennis, I've never seen a better tennis training situation for children than Coach Creasy's Total Tennis Training Camps. Chuck Creasy has coached them and trained them in every arena from juniors to collegiate to professional tennis, and over 15,000 children have improved their games at his summer tennis camps. Find out more at chuckcreasy.net. That's chuckcreasy.net.
And this is Coach Chuck Creasy, and I wanted to remind you about our 2015 Total Tennis Training Camps. This is my 40th summer of doing camps. We've had over 15,000 children through our camps. I've always talked about the physical, the mental, and the emotional balance that a youngster has to have in playing tennis. If you're a coach, parent, or a teacher, or you're the youngster listening to our show today, go to chuckcreasy.net and see the schedule for 2015 tennis camps at the Citadel and also in Sumter, South Carolina, Lexington, South Carolina, and maybe Cookeville, Tennessee. This summer, we will let you know about that camp soon. And we're back with American Tennis. This week, we're going to talk about the pathways to being a top player. If you're a parent, coach, or a player, There's several things that we'd like to talk about, starting with junior tennis, a little bit about college tennis as well. I wanted to mention, first of all, that since 1979, I've worked on momentum control. If you'll go back about a month, I did two and a half programs about momentum control. I really do believe that players can make decisions on the tennis court to control momentum, and just to learn about the power of momentum and to understand the relevance that it has in our scoring system, our beautiful traditional tennis scoring system, and in the sport of tennis is incredible. But Tennis Australia, the Tennis Australia magazine, in March of this year, March 2015, they ran a whole series on momentum and carried a good article called The Tennis Tug of War, written by Robert Davis. And really it highlights a lot of my ideas, and I'm very happy about the quotes that I have in there about my studies and all the work I've done. I've talked around the world really about this topic, and a lot of places are very, very interested in it because it is something that's not talked about too much. I believe that it has a very great impact on other sports. Anybody who watched the NCAA tournament this last weekend in basketball, I think, would agree with that, the momentum switches. And, boy, what a controversial call that was at the end, the one where the guy from Duke, sure, it looked like his hand hit that ball and knocked it out of bounds. They gave the ball to Duke, and that ended up being the clincher. But really the way that Duke made the comeback from 9 points down. But momentum is a huge, not just basketball, where they talk about the runs, but in tennis you don't have a clock. You have our fantastic scoring system where you have to learn how to win three in a row. And all of the rules, three in a row, starts to flow, and how to manage your lead when you're ahead with discipline, how to try to come back if you're trying to come back, what do you do when it's even, what do you do when your opponent hurts you or they make a bad mistake, what do you do after your winners, after your mistakes, how do you manage the time between points and between sets. These are all critical. And everybody has witnessed what happens when players may be losing, and I want to say it straight out, folks, but when they fake injuries on the WTA, that tour, it's just ridiculous how players fake injuries. Actually, I'm very proud that I helped get an ITA rule put in 2 years ago, where if a player has an injury, they have to award a one-point courtesy to the opponent for breaking their momentum. Now, I requested a one game. All you have to do is say, look, if a person has an injury, they have a medical timeout or any kind of timeout, let's a one-game courtesy. And then that'll just clean up the mess that we have out there with the fake injuries, and the chronic injuries. And I have got to say this, that in my 40 years since I started collegiate coaching in 1975, I've only coached one young man that had an acute injury on the court, and he ran his head into a backstop, and we had to get stitches. But you do not get injured by the act of tennis itself. It's usually a chronic injury. Now, there are things like overheating and cramping and those things that have caused many matches to be stopped. But other than that, the fake injuries have got to go. They've got to go. And we want to talk today about some of the things that might make sense in the training and working with your youngster. Last week we talked about the movie Whiplash and J.P. Weber's We Coach Tennis program on Tuesday of last week, which was April 1st and then April 2nd. It was J.P. Weber was Tuesday, March 31st, and April 1st was my program. If you'll go back there and listen, we talked a lot about, movie Whiplash, and was the guy in the movie over the top, or was this something that we've lost, the toughness in our coaching and our teaching? And it's pretty interesting. I mean, yeah, the guy was really over the top maybe in his abusive behavior and everything, but what do we do as coaches and teachers to really get players' attention and to get them to do things they don't want to do in order to have things that they want to have? Tom Landry's quote, coach's job is to get people to do things they don't want to do in order to have things they want to have. Or else coaches aren't coaches anymore. They're sort of community organizers, or they are, you know, after-school activity directors. And this is a frustrating thing if coaches can't find the correct leverage to use with players. Of course, it's got to be done in the right way. It's got to be done in a timely manner. But last week we were talking in depth with, I think, Coach Dave Guest was on the program. He was. And he is a very bright and excellent coach, future Hall of Fame coach, for sure. But he was took the side that the guy in Whiplash was over the top. We did get in a deep discussion, and I wanted to bring this up first about the formula I use to measure kids, youngsters, whether or not they will be successful in the future, and trying to trying to sort of predict their, whether or not they will be. And you can look at all three areas of ability plus opportunity plus desire, those three things. God-given ability, how much ability does the youngster have? This would be nature. Nature, nurture, and self, it's the nature part of it. How much ability does the youngster have? And this is God's job, and it's pretty much done when they are born. And the development of that has to do with the two other things, which are opportunities given by parents, coaches, and teachers, and also the desire part, which is up to the individual. So if you call it ability, opportunity, and desire, or you could call it nature, nurture, and self, those three. So here's the formula that we discussed last week. Over the years, I've had so many parents come up and ask me as a coach, "Coach, does my youngster have it? Can they become really, really good? They don't look like they are as coordinated as some of the other youngsters are. Listen, they look like they're really, really coordinated, but they don't work hard enough." And so I got tired of sort of just trying to predict it in generalities, and I've given them, instead of a subjective idea about it, I've given them a direct answer by saying that it's a three-part proposal. It's ability plus opportunity plus desire. That's nature plus opportunity is nurture plus self. And I'd say, let's rate your youngster on a scale of 1 to 10. So ability, the one youngster where the parent says they don't look as coordinated, he'll say, "Okay, my youngster's a 6. All right, that's fine. Opportunities, how are the opportunities that you've given him? Okay, an 8. We've given him pretty good opportunities, but not maybe as much as others. I'd say an 8. So 8, 6 plus 8, 6 on ability, 8 plus opportunity, that's 14. How much desire does your youngster have? Well, they coach, they're on the backboard every day, at least an hour. They hit serves. I mean, my golly, my youngster had to use Band-Aids on his hands because there were so many cracks and so many blisters and things that it's hard. Well, so what's the desire part here on your youngster? They'll say, "Oh, it's a 10. Okay, so let's say it's a 8 plus a 6 plus an 8, 14 plus a 10, that's a 24. So the answer to the parents, I say, okay, 24. I've done this for so long that I have got to tell you, 23 to 25 is a magic number. If they have less than 23, no chance. In other words, if that youngster only has an 8, they have 6 in ability, 8 in opportunity, and an 8 as far as attitude and hard work, 22, they're not going to make it. Too bad, so sad, that's the way it goes," says your dad. And it's just, if you're lacking too much in one of those areas, you're probably not going to make it. If you're lacking in two, you have no chance. Let's say if the person's ability was a five, or let's say a four, and they would have to have 10 in opportunity and a 10 in desire. That's a 24. Yeah, you've seen a lot of people. Some people make it with this, but the desire has to be through the roof if the person doesn't have average to good ability. Youngsters will show you, if you're a parent out there, what they really have the inclination for or the aptitude for and inclination to do. And they'll let you know what they love. It's hard for kids to stay in things where they don't have any success. And it's pretty cool when they will practice over and over and over and over to get things right. But academics, you could look at that. You could look at the academics, the youngster's aptitude. They're nine. They're very bright. You send them to the best schools. But if they're lazy and they only try to a four, they have a 9, 9, and a four, that's a 22, and they're not going to do well. And this is the way it works. So the ability part, there's not much you can do. You can't put in what the good Lord left out. And when the good Lord, you know, has given a person great ability, I always laugh at the kids. I say, what did Spider-Man, what about Spider-Man? They say, with great ability comes great responsibility. Or you could go the biblical way, to whom much is given, much is expected. But it's a funny thing, and but it's I shouldn't say it's funny, but it's an absolute that when youngsters have more ability, they get afraid of it. And a lot of times they will self-sabotage when they have a lot of ability, because that ability is a responsibility. And but it's a constant. It can't be done, can't be changed. The opportunity and the desire part are sort of opposed to each other. Because the more opportunities you give a youngster, a lot of times the less desire they have. And a lot of times if they have tremendous desire, they don't have any opportunities. You like to see that, but they need the opportunities as well. These three go hand in hand, and I wanted to point this out again before we get into the talking about our junior tennis. And I wanted to talk about scheduling. And as your youngster comes up, when is the right time to start competition? When is the right time to do it? And I want to say this out of the blocks, that I've been coaching tennis for 43 years, and I have 11, 9, and 7-year-old, and none of them have played their first tournament yet. All of them can hit the ball, and we go out for family outings. None of them have played a tournament yet because they're just not ready. You can see it, you can tell it, you can tell it, and it's they're just not ready. They don't want to, they don't show any interest to, and I think my 7-year-old daughter are very, they look like they're going to really like competition of tennis, and I'm going to put them in tournaments when, now and then I'll bleed them into local things and just get a feel for what it feels like, what it's like to play one against one, and what it's like to compete one-on-one. And my older daughter, she's doing fantastic in swimming, and that is her sport right now, and it's pretty fun to watch. And, she's going to be probably a good high school player. And we'll see how that one goes. But as far as junior readiness to play tournaments, that the kids will let you know. A lot of times it's who they hang out with and who their friends are. And that has a lot to do with it. But I wanted to make this point, though, with that. The USTA is extremely, extremely involved and extremely concerned whether or not events are participation or performance events. Now, they don't have a split or a split between these two. And I really do think that in their management or their management of these events and how they set them up, they need to really have a split. And my children, like as they're getting involved, my 11, 9, 7-year-old, they would go into they would go into participation events, social events. But you need to know that the other tournament weekend over here is a performance event. This is one for rankings and for some big rewards if you do well, and if you don't do well, you get sent home. And it's more serious, and they need to make this definition between those two. I don't think they have, and really my belief is that I think everybody who plays tennis thinks they're in a performance group. I think the men's 3.5 league at the park or the women's league tennis, they think they're really into performance activities, and they're not. They're into participation activities, and I think we need to make this definitive statement that there is a difference between these two. But freedom is the most important thing in our country. And the fact that we are getting less and less freedom and more regulations through the structure of events is just very disheartening. And I think that I've always believed that the computers have sort of done us a disservice here. It's allowed people who are number two people in management to have too many leadership opportunities. Leaders are visionaries. Leaders do right things more than managers who do things right. Both are needed. But with the computers, I just think we're doing too much bean counting. And that point system they have, folks, is a killer. You know and I know that the point system is a killer. We need to go back to the head-to-head competition. Coach Randy Blumendahl, he has not yet come on the line, so I want to talk here just a few more minutes about his idea. I want to sort of open this up, but his idea on college tennis and the way it should be set up. But in junior tennis, my proposal was that you have everybody was arguing or discussing whether you or not you have rankings versus ratings. And, of course, the idea with those third-party consultants was that the rankings are bad for kids. And my contention was that, no, it's not for the very top ones. It's we should have rankings for the top 40, tier 60, or maybe even 75 national players. Maybe you have only 40 kids ranked. But then the second group, let's say the top 20% of your kids then are ranked, or top 15%. And then the second group, you have ratings. The middle group is where we've really messed up since computers have come into play. The middle group of players, the rankings really don't mean much. It's really not such a good thing when you see a kid who'll say, I was ranked 380 and I moved up to 275. And even though that sounds pretty good, it pretty much, it's like, hey, listen, this was mediocre here and I'm a little less mediocre. And I don't mean that as a slam to anybody, but we can do better. I think the rating system would be very appropriate for the middle 60% of kids or youngsters. So let's say we have 1 to 60 in our country or in our section or in our state, whatever your rankings are, the top 15 or 20% of the kids should be ranked. The middle group of youngsters should be rated. You have a rating system where the kids earn their way and they can move up in a rating. Now, point system might work for that. So that's where you use that point system that the USTA instigated and everything, and that'll encourage kids, hey, they can go out and chase their points if they wanted to do that. But head-to-head competition is much, much more important. Now, that brings in then the last 20 or last 15% of kids. What we need there is a self-advancement type of program where youngsters could go out and use a program like the GRIPS program. Look up gripsprogram.com if you want to see a great individual advancement program, and it copies the karate belts and the way that the karate has been used. My son and daughters were into karate the older ones were into karate for like 4 years, and they were always motivated to get that next belt. So those are okay for the lower and the middle groups types of ratings, but the rankings need to be pure. And we need to go back to the head-to-head system. I do have one caller here right now. I'm going to see if the caller has anything to add. Caller area code 269, do you have anything you want to talk about today in American tennis?
Yes, Coach, how you doing?
Fine. Who's this, please?
Eric Melville from Ohio. I called once
Hey,
before.
Eric. Hey, good.
Yeah,
it's
funny that you're talking about ranking systems, because I've been a coach, you know, for a number of years. And I would always tell the kids, after a certain ranking, it's no longer a ranking, it's just a prison number. So if you're, you know, if you're outside the top 100, as far as I was concerned nationally, it's not a low-dollar ranking. That's just a prison number, and we shouldn't even discuss it. So I thought that was pretty interesting that's one of the topics that you're talking about right now. But earlier I heard you were talking about basically, you know, and I wish I got into this a little sooner, but the whole quick start, you know, process and using dead balls when we weren't smart enough to know what quick start was, I guess. But I remembered seeing Venus and Serena and Richard when they were younger. Venus was 6 years old, and I'm from Saginaw, Michigan, so they would come there because they had family there. And it's interesting because he would always use dead ball. He told him to hit it harder, swing harder, swing harder. And they'd swing 25, 30, 40 balls. They'd miss a ball. And I swear to you, okay, why'd you miss that ball? I don't know, Daddy, why did I miss that ball? I don't know. You look at television and you see the tennis players on television just like I do what they're doing. And people may not believe it or not, but those girls' swing has not gotten remarkably different from when they were 10 years old. Venus still moves the same way. She still moves like, you know, this gangly 6-8-year-old. Serena still more athletic, still moves the same way. You know, so my thing is that, you know, we talk about, you know, all this USDA with bringing psychologists and bringing these people and that people. Shouldn't you think we should just get back to simplicity and let the coaches coach? You know, because with Quick Start, it's like really asking a person, a bellhop, to now perform plastic surgery. Because Quick Start is actually vastly more complicated than just rolling out dead balls. So you're trying to get these guys that really don't know the nuances of coaching little kids, and then you give them even more complicated situations to coach the kids. It's just disaster waiting to happen. I see where I teach out of, see these guys, and no fault of their own, but now you put so much more complexity in what they're doing. It's just, and the kids are lost, they're lost, and basically they just end up throwing the foam balls at each other. You know, so what
Coach,
do you think about, you know?
Coach, you bring up so many good thoughts and ideas. Let me comment here on them, and then I'd like to get your comments again. Coach Eric up there in Ohio, thank you. But what he says, he brings in so many things that we from the outside set up a program in the system, and then we say, okay, kids, fit in to the system, fit in to the program, fit in to what we have developed. And number one, that kills creativity and it kills innovation. But I wanted to make this point to Derek and then everybody out there, that I use the idea, I use dead balls back in the early 90s, because through the 80s I learned that we were going to a place where ball striking overcame movement. The synergy was gone. When they changed the rackets, they didn't change the balls, they didn't change the courts. The synergy was messed up, and a lot of people would say it's still messed up, but players have adapted and they've learned how to move. But they created this whole new industry, and they went from quick start to play and stay and these, and they felt like maybe the Europeans were getting ahead. And always I've said any tool that works is a great teaching tool. So I've called these great teaching tools. My problem, Eric, and came and everybody else out there, was when they said there was a mandate that you had to do it this way. That's where I took issues. That's where I drew a line. So I talked even to one of the top USTA folks, and I said to them, I said, look, and I said, you guys said you went through play and stay, quick start, and they had a couple other things, and it didn't work. Well, here's what you guys did. It's like taking a line call. You say it didn't work. It's like losing 6-4 in the third to somebody, losing 7-5 in the third to somebody, 6-2 in the third to somebody. And then the fourth time you're playing them, you weren't getting what you wanted, so you took a line call at 5-5 in the third, and you went overboard, and you did not wait, catch on to the law of ideas. You forced everybody's hand, and this is where I have the problem. So, Eric, I'll give you one more word here, and I got another caller came on. What are your thoughts, Eric? That's okay. What got my dander up about that.
You see, and this, you know, and going along the same lines, and I'll be short. You know, I work with Tom Walker next to me on the court, and I work with Jack Shove next to me on the court for years.
Because they're doing the best out there, yeah.
Yes, we work with some of the same people, and we were vastly different in our approach, but it worked. You know, we both have, all three of us had different ideas, different ways to go about it, and we try to work together and collaborate. And I agree with you. You know, now it's, and that's why I stopped going to the USDA conventions, you know, USPTA conventions, because of the same thing. You know, this is what we see, this is what we need to do, you know, so I agree with you. You know, to each his own, and we'll all get there different paths. Thanks, Coach.
Coach, thank you for your comments and thoughts, and that's the deal. I mean, tennis is a creative sport. I love Mike Knodels, what he said a few months ago. He was on the show, and he said, where would Skip Fosbury have been with the Fosbury flop? Would it ever, would we have ever had people jumping backwards? Who would have ever thought about that? Because for years they went over forward. But what we're going to do, we do not want cookie cutter tennis. If you have cookie cutter tennis, you're going to, daggone, you're going to take the individuality away from the kids. And again, it's a good teaching tool. But I just tell you, it's my way of thinking. I'm telling you what I'm doing with my youngsters. I teaching them two hands on both sides with full-size racket, and it is beautiful to see their lower body transfer the weight and get the torque. And no, they're not hurting themselves. And yes, they use the weight of the racket for the stroke instead. We have a caller on the line here, code 347-515. Thoughts, would you like to comment today on the show? Area code 347. Area code 347, okay, they're not here. All right, I wanted to talk a little bit, Eric, there works with Tom Walker and Jack Sharp, and if you wanted to spend any money wisely, go up and be 1 weekend and go to Chicago and just go and watch Jack Sharp and meet him, and one of the more brilliant peoples out there. Tom Walker's had lots of great players as well, but innovation, creativity, do it your way, make your way number one in the world at doing it your way. We always tell players that you don't have to be the best. You always have to be your best. You need to be number one in the world at being you. We need innovation. We need creativity. And I know that the USTA, they're after champions, and they're after trying to make some champions. But champions make the champions. We as teachers just give them the tools and the guidelines and a perspective along the way. But I wanted to, Coach Blumenthal, no, it's not him. So I'm going to wait and see if he comes on. But I wanted to throw out a few other things there, what we really, really need to do with junior tennis right now. One of the things is that recent years we have plugged in so many consolation events that it's been laughable in most cases. You know, and I know, if you run junior events out there, see them. that the kids, the amount of defaults and the back draws, when kids go from the front of the tournament to the back draw and they play a 10-point tiebreaker for the third set, the kids are pulling out right and left with what I call phantom or mysterious injuries. And just basically, it's not working, the consolation events. Here's my thought on that. We need to reinstate two out of three completely competitive sets for doubles again, and make doubles more important than the consolation singles events, just like we had it in years gone by. Now, where does, if you had this, there's a couple things would happen. The rites of passage that youngsters have in order to improve their game come from two things and two things only. One is that they mark their improvement by head-to-head wins and rivalries over other top players. That's number one. The other two is the advancement and the winning of tournaments of heritage, whether it's a Kalamazoo or the U.S. clay courts or events even within someone's state. Whether you win the state JC's tournament or the state high school 5A event, tournaments of heritage also give players confidence plus a rite of passage that, hey, I have arrived and I've done this. But the rivalries cause this. The point system is taken away from our rivalries. Kids duck events. Youngsters don't care about picking up the points in the back draw, because they don't get penalized for just pulling out of the tournaments. The other rite of passage that nobody sees really is that I always, as a coach, would say players develop as great doubles players before they develop as great singles players. Your rite of passage usually happens is you advance through tournaments into doubles events, and you find yourself on championship day side by side with the number one or the number four, number three seeds. They're playing the championship singles. You're playing the championship doubles. This is a rite of passage. I would contend that rites of passage do not happen with 10-point tiebreakers. When someone wins a 10-point tiebreaker, that's sort of like kissing your sister or kissing your brother for you women. It's not really a win. Everybody knows it. It's a 10-point tiebreaker. It was something people throw in there to get it over with. You know that it's not an official match. When you win close matches, 7-5 in the third, 7-6 in the thirds, and you beat a really good player, 7-5 in the third, that it's even more important to beat a good player 7-5 in the third than to beat a good player 2-3 when the other player wasn't playing well. When you beat a good player in a close head-to-head match, you have a rite of passage. Doubles matches have to be two out of three sets. Eight-game pro set, the results are skewed. A lot of very average players win, and a lot of very good players lose. So wins don't really mean so much, and losses, here's the bigger thing that most people have not looked at, but when you lose and it hurts a lot, you get better. You go practice, and you make sure that you don't have that same pain again. So it's very, very important to have full matches for doubles, full matches for singles. Top priority should be the singles main draw. Second priority should be two out of three sets in doubles. And if you have to have a consolation event, what you do is you play one-round consolation, or you put together a side tournament. You could call it sidekick tournament if you wanted to. It's just really a shame that our tournaments are not helping players become the total players that they can be. Full matches, two out of three sets, are critical. NOAAD scoring should never be used. And, folks, I've got two full shows on NOAAD scoring. If you'll go back 2 months ago, go look at chuckcreasy.net at my website and go to American Tennis Radio and look at the discussions on NOAAD scoring. But right now we have this debate, dispute, and really nearly a civil war over the NOAAD scoring controversy. And people have asked me, why are they promoting it politically? they've got their reasons, but the shame is that some of the teams understand that it is immediate parity. We had number 51 Tulsa beat number 1 Southern California earlier this year, and we had many, many upsets of players and teams based on the skewed results from NOAAD scoring. NOAAD scoring is a travesty. Believe me, I had to coach it from 1979, I believe 78, 79, up until the early 90s, and I've seen a lot of great players that shoulda, coulda, woulda been great dismantled because you just basically have to take so many losses, and it skews the results, and it's a travesty, and we need to stay away from it if we can with our youngsters. You know, Coach Blumendahl was not able to join us today. We've had some good, interesting conversations about junior tennis and what's going on in our country. But I want to leave with one really, really big thought. There, and this is the deal. You know, it's about education versus entertainment. And if we had just understand with our youngsters, it's about education. And I would ask you to go watch that movie Whiplash, and as brutal as it is in some ways, it'll get you thinking about our education system and how we're failing our youngsters as well. Comfort never breeds any fruit. Comfort breeds no fruit. It bears no fruit. We cannot ask our children to rise to high occasions later in their life if they're not challenged while they're young in their life. But it's always the education part of it is not something where kids just have fun and they automatically they're exposed to something and then they get good at it. Youngsters learn when they become passionate about what they're doing, and then they actively take the role in developing themselves. Again, ability, desire, opportunity. Ability, opportunity, desire. The desire part, the nurture, nature, self. The self part is 10 times more important than the nurturing. It always comes down to that youngster and his or her own burning desire. The entertainment part of it, shame on those folks that think that abbreviating or bastardizing our most beautiful game in the world and our beautiful scoring system could ever make it popular. When you dumb things down, you do not stimulate desire. You do not stimulate long-term interest. You do not stimulate the heart. The heart is stimulated by those things that are hard, those type of things that bring hardship when you fail, those type of things that give you great joy when you win. This is a highly passionate and competitive sport. Passion is different than performance. We need to treat them as such. And then two, and last message to our governing bodies, bureaucracies. You guys try all you want to implement systems. Youngsters need incentives. You've got to do those things that inspire our youngsters. You've got to do those things that make our youngsters hurt at times because they don't succeed but have great joy when they do succeed. You don't do this with just whimsical, fun things. To the coaches out there, you be who you are, 100% innovative in your own way. We need innovation, creativity. We need your heart involved to be the person and be number one in the world at being who you are. As
made in America, born in a heartland, raised up a family, a King James and Uncle Sam. He got the red, white, blue, fine high on a farm. Semper Fi tattooed on his Simpsons. Spent a little more in the store for a tag in the back of this USA. Won't buy nothing that he can't fix. With WD-40 and a Craftsman wrench, he ain't president. He's just made in America.
Creasy reminding you that you're in the process of winning or losing every day of your life and has very little to do with a win or a loss. This is Coach Chuck Creese, American Tennis, and we will see you next week. God bless you all.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.